You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
People take a step back and are a bit more rational. I think most people would elect to be in the EU, and the Nigel Farages of the world are still on the margins, you know, European-wide.
From elections in Europe to another in Cairo, we'll review the day's top stories here in the studio with Daniela Peled and Raffaello Pantucci. Then, what happens when a controversial Serbian coach attempts to lead South Sudan's first national football team after decades of civil war? We'll meet the director of the new documentary, Coach Zoran and His African Tigers. And later in the programme...
So, the devil is a lie. Them other girls can't compete with mine. You do it so good, you fuck my mind. You pull it out.
We'll review the latest and greatest in the music world with Raff Rundell of the London-based musical duo The Two Bears. All that, plus we'll be in Vancouver too. That's all ahead on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next hour here on the show. Before we start though, let's get the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Dozens of pro-Russian separatists have died in an offensive by Ukrainian troops in the eastern city of Donetsk. Government forces have taken control of the airport there, seized by a heavily armed group overnight on Monday. The assault came within hours of the presidential election in Ukraine, won by the billionaire Petro Poroshenko. US President Barack Obama's congratulated him on his victory and offered US support as he seeks to unify the country. Moscow has called for an end to the offensive against separatists. New Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has told Pakistan that it must prevent militants on its territory from attacking India. He's met with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in New Delhi and said that the talks were cordial. The countries have agreed to try to restart peace talks. Boko Haram gunmen have attacked a Nigerian military base and a police barracks, killing at least 24 security personnel. Security sources said the simultaneous attacks happened in the northeastern town of Buniyadi. That's not far from where the Islamist insurgents killed 59 pupils at a boarding school in February. Meanwhile, residents in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, have reacted angrily after the country's military said they knew where more than 200 schoolgirls were, but didn't want to use force to free them. The girls were abducted by Boko Haram last month.
We need action. How do I mean? They need to apply principle of diplomacy. They need to be, federal government and the military, they need to be diplomatic in their approach to get those girls out of the captivities.
The French President François Hollande says the weekend's elections to the European Parliament show there's a need to change the way the EU works. In France, the far-right Front National won around a quarter of votes, pushing Mr. Hollande's socialists into third place. EU leaders are meeting to discuss how to respond to the rise of Eurosceptic and far-right parties in many countries. Barack Obama is set to announce an intention to leave nearly 10,000 US troops in Afghanistan after the formal troop withdrawal at the end of this year. The US president held talks with military commanders at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan on Sunday, where it's thought the figure was agreed. Washington is hopeful that the next Afghan president will sign a bilateral security agreement, which will allow some international forces to stay. The proposal from the US would see 9,800 troops stay for a year, cutting that by half by the end of 2015. There are currently 32,000 US troops in Afghanistan. Malaysia's government and British satellite firm Inmarsat have released data used to determine the path of missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 after calls from passengers' relatives for greater transparency. The data runs to 47 pages about the aircraft's movements after it disappeared from civilian radar screens on March the 8th. Meanwhile, officials say global standards to track aircraft in real time may not be ready for 2 to 3 years. Nancy Graham is director of the International Civil Aviation Organization Air Navigation Bureau and told reporters after a gathering of the industry in Kuala Lumpur what their priority is.
Real-time streaming of data from the aircraft itself and how we might go about doing that using the IT properties and the IT kinds of disciplines that ITU is working with. So we're working in partnership to do that together. And as Malcolm said, we have a number of actions that we've agreed to take together.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. More news from David Spencer at the bottom of the hour. Of course, he'll return with a full bulletin for you at 1900 hours here in London. Right now, though, it's 5 past 1800 in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, joining me with their take on the news of the day here in Studio One are both Daniela Peled, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always, of course. We'll start today's show in Europe, where leaders are wrestling with the results of the weekend's polls for the European Parliament. A number of mainstream politicians are calling for the EU and its oft-maligned institutions to heed the warning served up by their citizenry in the form of record gains for populist parties, many of whom sit unpalatably far to the right of the political spectrum. A little earlier, Dan Bilewski, a Paris-based reporter for the New York Times, spoke about what Brussels means for voters across Europe.
I think when people take a step back and you look at what the European Union offers, I mean, it's the world's biggest trading bloc. It's a huge consumer market. The free movement of people across borders, you know, a young kid from Britain being able to go and work in France or in Spain, these kind of benefits at a very visceral, emotional level are really, really positive, having a single currency in your pocket. So, I mean, if people take a step back and are a bit more rational, I think most people would elect to be in the EU, and the Nigel Farages of the world are still on the margins, you know, European-wide. Having said all that, you know, Europe has become remote. The European Parliament itself has become something of a traveling circus, you know, 100 million euros a year so that it can decamp from, you know, Brussels to Strasbourg. The debates are very arcane. No one is really listening in. So, you know, there needs to be something done about this disconnect between these institutions and the people. But at a very rudimentary level, the EU is still a positive thing. You know, and at a fundamental level, it has stopped war on this continent.
That was Dan Bilewski, a Paris-based reporter for the New York Times. Raffaello, if I can start with you. François Hollande, the French president, says the results were painful, which I presume he meant not just in immediate political terms. He also mentioned, as Dan Bilewski did there, about this remoteness from the people. Is that a fundamental problem, that this is an institution or a group of institutions that have become simply too remote from the people it's supposed to represent?
I think that's probably a pretty accurate characterization. And I think what in some ways we might see in these results, which could be less worrying maybe than the sort of immediate analysis, is that what we're seeing here is publics punishing the current governments rather necessarily than being something they're voting for anything related to the European Union. The European Union and European Parliament and all the other Euro entities that exist in Brussels, I think are seen as pretty remote creations. I mean, I can't imagine how many times I've seen people do that sort of poll to a room of people of, who's your member of European Parliament? Do you have any idea? And, you know, I could ask the two of you. Do either of you know who your MEP is?
Let's not do that right now.
Let's move on quickly. But the point being that it is that very distant thing. So what ends up happening is when these elections happen, I think people will basically say, well, I'm angry at my government at the moment. I have an election. Perfect opportunity to beat them with a stick. And we've seen the French do this before with the European Constitution. When the Constitution was being written, which was something that was written by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, it was a French document written by a French minister for with French interests at heart, it was the French public who rejected it because they were not happy with Jacques Chirac's administration. And in some ways, what we could be seeing here is similar things. Publics are angry at their governments at the moment, and they're punishing them through this latest election. I think if we look at turnout numbers, they're pretty low. We're not really seeing massive support, you know, and I think in some countries, certainly in the United Kingdom, I can see UKIP has done well in these elections. I still remain to be convinced that they're going to do anywhere near as well to get even one parliamentary seat when we come to national elections. And I suspect the same can be said for a lot of European countries.
We'll talk a bit more about some of those populist parties in a moment. But on that point, Daniela, do you think that, I mean, Cameron in this country has said, you know, it cannot be business as usual anymore. Is he just saying all the right things? Or do you think that he'll probably share some of Rafaela's views in the sense that he knows this is a midterm punishment and that, you know, come next year, the situation will probably look rather better for the Conservatives if no one else?
Yeah, UKIP are not going to be representative of some major swathes of the British electorate next year. I think we can be quite confident of that. And the fact is, in that the current political landscape is Nigel Farage is a bloke. You know, he's a bloke. He's a political bloke. That's what the British like. You know, there's a photo of him which has been used to ad infinitum, which shows him grinning with an empty pint of beer glass on his head.
I have it here. It's on the front of the Wall Street Journal.
He is rarely.
But isn't there something more sinister? There's something more sinister about him, though, isn't there? He's not just a blokey chap down the pub. He represents, and within his party, there are a lot of pretty undesirable characters.
That's
and
the
they've
issue.
Polled 27%
right.
of the votes. Now, admittedly, turnout was fairly low. Over a quarter, the first time in a century the Tories or Labour didn't win a national poll. I mean, that is something we should be worried about, ashamed of, shouldn't we?
Well, the question is, I think, with UKIP is when it stops being an embarrassment in terms of British politics and it starts feeling dangerous. I don't think we've got to that point yet. I mean, UKIP, you know, I've written at length about this before. I think UKIP is the British response to the rise of the xenophobic parties in Europe. That's the British version. You know, in Britain, we are as xenophobic perhaps as anybody else, but we're a little bit too polite to come out straight and say so. You know, this is a much more watered down version. British people are not going to take the kind of uniformed, marching, proto-fascist style politics that seems to be making inroads elsewhere in Europe.
Raffaello, do you class them then in a different sort of category from, say, the Front National across the Channel? Because again, you know, huge gains. Yeah. It remains to be seen, similarly, whether they can translate those into gains in terms of domestic politics. But are UKIP in a different class? Are we wrong to perhaps bracket these populist groups together in one loose body like that?
I think we are wrong to bracket them all together, and they don't bracket themselves together. Nigel Farage made quite a clear point that he wants to distance himself from Marine Le Pen, seeing her as a racist, and he says, I'm not that.
And Marine Le Pen is not exactly the same thing
exactly.
with the other European
right.
parties.
And so I think that it's not a coherent movement that we're dealing with. I think it's lots of pieces that we can sometimes put together. In some ways, what I think is more worrying about these sorts of parties is the impact they have on the mainstream parties and the impact of having the fact that the Tories in this country now feel like they have a party that's more far right to them on certain issues that they have to compete with. And so it drags them further to the right. And so then you have a mainstream party that's going in that direction. I think in France, you've already seen this with Sarkozy's party, I'm completely forgetting the name of it right now, but the sort of centre-right party that we have in France, it has already clearly moved to try to compete with that space because it feels like it has to and it sees its constituents going in that direction. And so in some ways, these sorts of parties, that's the danger of them, is that they drag the entire body politic in a negative direction. I think fundamentally, UKIP, when it comes to national elections, they're not going to hold together because they don't really have a clear and coherent party structure. I think Farage and his own party secretary disagree fundamentally on a number of key issues. So when it comes to presenting a manifesto, I mean, good luck pulling that together.
No, I mean, I quite agree. The issue, I mean, this morning I found myself in the rather unfortunate and unfashionable position of agreeing with Tony Blair when he was speaking to the BBC and saying that Labour's main risk now was to stop trying to court the sector they feel they may be losing to UKIP, not to turn right, not to turn Eurosceptic. He made a lot of sense. Now, I mean, he's got his own interest in Europe, but I quite agree, that's the problem. So the populist politics, and it's very easy to score points that when it comes to Europe. I mean, Europe is great for those with opportunities. If you've got the opportunities to travel from country to country and you've got euros in your pocket, it's great. For people with fewer opportunities to travel and fewer opportunities for flexibility in their life, it actually seems like this amorphous, threatening body with a whole horde of people coming to take your job away.
Rafael,
you... Well, I was just going to say, there are also some fundamental problems in the European. I mean, the problem I always have with it is I'm very pro-European, you know, as a person with an Italian parent who's brought up in the United Kingdom, I've got a natural sort of continental affinity, if you will. But it always depresses me when I deal with the European institutions to see some of the bureaucracy and waste that goes on there. For example,
all the cliches are true.
Do we need to have two parliamentary seats, one in Brussels, one in Strasbourg? All this means is a huge travel budget going between one and the other, which is completely superfluous. So there are fundamental problems with the EU that do need reform. But I think the approach that sort of the Farages and the Marine Le Pen of this world are taking is just not really the sort of solution.
Do we risk, I wonder, losing sight of a dissatisfaction with exactly those kinds of things you're talking about, the red tape, the bureaucracy, the sort of inefficiencies within the system, because we're too quick to say, well, this will never be repeated on a domestic political election. These people are scaremongers. You know, it's populist parties on the right and in the left. We saw in Greece, for example, that some have got leftist parties making lots of progress. Do we risk perhaps ignoring the fact that 4.3 million people in this country, for example, did cast their vote that way? Are they actually making a broader comment about the EU, Daniela, possibly?
Yeah, look, the EU is incredibly unwieldy. It does a very rubbish job at selling itself. The fact is I agree, it's been a force for good in post-war Europe. You know, we saw France and Germany at each other's throats for much of the first part of the 20th century. Now they're at the heart of it's all kinds of positive benefits, but this hasn't been part of the message it's been sent. And I think there has been a worrying trend. I mean, we shouldn't lump all of these parties together, but there has been a worrying trend across Europe in the last 10 years at least of fear of the other, fear of the outsider. I think the opening up of new markets has brought this to do. I would not want to subscribe to the clash of civilizations theory, right. But then there's another issue with the North African population in France, all kinds of issues of identity and citizenship, which Europe as a continent hasn't necessarily dealt with in the best way. Some places have suffered more than others, but we are very far off from creating this idea of a European identity. There hasn't been very much work done on it. I don't think it's really possible.
Let's move from one set of elections to another election that's been taking place in Egypt, of course. Polling's actually been extended in that country's presidential elections, a bid to try and boost turnout there as well, where there are some concerns, perhaps well-founded, about the degree of turnout. I wonder in this case, Daniela, if I start with you, a high turnout or relatively high turnout, is this just a sort of a simple tool to legitimise the winner who, let's say, speculatively, will probably be
a general Al-Sisi. Let's speculate a little bit.
Let's make it interesting.
Is it a simple function? He needs to be seen to command the support of the public, given what's preceded in the last 2-3 years.
You know, it struck me that actually the upcoming Syrian elections has a wider field. You know, Assad faces more opposition than Sisi. I don't know. You know, he's made very little effort in terms of campaigning. There's been no live debates. I'm not quite sure. It wouldn't be much of a live debate, not a great number of people for him to debate with. He only released his manifesto a few days before the polls. One of the most embarrassing things, and we return to the EU for a moment here, is that the EU is sending election observers to the elections, which I find really, really embarrassing. It legitimises it. Yeah, it would do him some good if there was a higher turnout. The fact is, you know, it's impossible to tell, but had there been a wider field, had there been proper campaigning, had there been an atmosphere of political freedom, it's not inconceivable that he wouldn't have won anyway. I think there is a genuine support amongst conservative elements, of which there are a lot in Egypt, that stability, that Sisi is actually what they want, despite the costs to democracy as we see it.
Rafael, I wonder, the fact that voting numbers will be down on last time, is that a reflection perhaps of this reality that, you know, when an ostensibly democratic election result is overturned through whatever various reasons and machinations, that affects people's engagement with the whole political process? Is that why the results are down? People say, well, look, we took part last time and it didn't actually make any difference. The government we returned was removed within months.
No, I'm sure to an awful lot of people, they'll look at it and say, well, what's the point? I mean, really, what is the point? You know, we joke about who's likely to win this, but I'm sure if you're a member of the Egyptian electorate, it's a reality for you, and it's quite a depressing one. If you're looking at it and you're saying, well, you know, last time we voted, the guy got booted out. This time it's pretty clear who's going to win. Why should I bother showing up on the day, really? What's the point? I fully endorse that. I mean, I find what's happening in Egypt incredibly depressing, because we're seeing here what looks to me like a cycle of what we've seen happen repeatedly before, and it's only ended in violence every single time. And the fact that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood government under Morsi may have been a troubled and difficult regime, and it really was very problematic. It didn't resolve a lot of the questions it was meant to resolve. But at the same time, its sort of defenestration and the mass arrests of the Muslim Brotherhood, the sort of mass convictions, six, 700 people, death, two consecutive trials of death sentences issued to these people. You know, what are you doing here? You're essentially removing the party from office, throwing everyone in jail and putting death sentences on the rest. This is a clearer sort of, and then the military leader is taking off his uniform. He's not even really taking it off, is he? I mean, I'm pretty sure I've seen lots of photos of him still in his uniform campaigning, and is just going to sweep back into power. I mean, what has really changed in this country? And think of all the hope and optimism that's around Tahrir Afswar and the potential for a sort of democracy actually coming to Egypt, which would have a transformative effect across the Middle East. You know, if a genuine democracy was to really take root in Egypt, which is the cradle of, you know, a lot of Arab thinking and, you know, civilization, it would be transformative. Instead, we're just seeing the same depressing cycle of, you know, military man throwing out a democratic government, taking over again and, you know, rigging the vote.
That's Raffaello Pantucci, Daniela Pellad too, still with me here on Midori House. When we come back, amongst other things, we'll talk about the Pope. He's been in the Middle East. What did he like most? Israeli falafel, Palestinian tabbouleh? We'll find out after this.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me here in Studio One are both Daniela Pellad and Raffaello Pantucci. We'll look now at the Supreme Pontiff. He completed his Middle East tour yesterday, visiting Jerusalem's Old City. Pope Francis toured the sites of the most holy sites for both Jews and Muslims, and he urged all people of all faiths to work together for peace. What chances of that, Raffaello? If we can't even agree about Israeli falafel, Palestinian tabbouleh, is there any chance of a broader unity, even if Pope Francis is sticking his oar in?
I mean, we've talked about Middle East, peace between Palestinians and Israelis for many years now, and you know, I don't know that this particular visit is really going to change a huge amount. I think it's good that the Pontiff goes there and makes these sorts of sounds when we're looking at a global situation of great tension between the sort of various religious groups, and so it helps to have someone of his standing. And I think, you know, I think the Pontiff has done a good job of coming into his job and really projecting this face of being a very sort of accommodating and warm and open leader of the Catholic faith. So I think it's positive. I don't really see much is going to change as a result of this visit, to be honest, though.
His openness and the warmth that Raffaello describes there, could that rub off on some of these other characters he's been meeting along the way?
Well, yeah, all these lovely warm and friendly and friendly characters. Look, it's been a very, very positive visit for one person and one institution. That's Pope Francis. He judged it perfectly. The wonderful there's been some controversy over whether it was unscheduled or not, but his detour at the separation wall, praying there, then praying at the Western Wall, fantastic photo opportunities. He brought his two best mates from Argentina with him, a Muslim, a Jew. Perfectly judged. He only made other people look a bit silly. So he did very, very well. And it could have been different, because the situation of Catholics and Christians in general in Israel and the Palestinian territories is quite thorny. Israel says that it's the rise of Muslim fundamentalism that has driven the Christian population out. Other people say that they suffer just as much under Israeli occupation, but the Christians have, you know, tend to be more more upwardly mobile and more able to leave the Middle East. So trying to visit and provide solidarity while not making some awful political faux pas was quite thorny. I think he did well. I think he passes, really.
And he also visited the Holocaust Memorial, of course. And there was some people who suggested that in itself was significant because there had been claims, of course, about the role or otherwise of the Vatican during the Holocaust. Do you think there was still some bridges to rebuild for him in that respect as well? Or do you think people in that area have largely managed to kind of overcome their suspicions about that period
in history? No, look, suspicions are so deeply rooted, you know, going back thousands of years of conflict between Judaism and the Catholic Church. Let's leave the Muslims and the Inquisition out of it as well. So there are definite still tensions. But once again, he went to Yad Vashem. He showed humility. He kissed the hands of Holocaust survivors. He spoke movingly. You can't fault him.
And just before we move on, Raffaello, in terms of the involvement then of religious leaders in these sorts of conflicts, which obviously become so political and so geographical, are they best keeping a safe distance? Or do you think that in broad terms, his role and his engagement with all of the different sides in this is something to welcome?
No, I think they're exactly the sorts of people who should get involved as deeply as they can. And I think exactly as Daniel was pointing out, bringing these two figures, you know, a Muslim and Jewish colleague to visit these holy places, visiting both the shrines, he's in a position that he can do that. And so I think those sorts of signals are exactly the sorts of things that he should be doing. He should be exactly breaking the sorts of boundaries that, you know, a politician, you could not imagine Barack Obama going to do a lot of these because it would be so politically sensitive at home, regionally, around the world.
But if Barack Obama did it, it might actually make a concrete difference.
Well, that's the depressing side of this whole debate, is that you're right. It might actually change something. But unfortunately, this is the role that I think these sorts of spiritual leaders have, which is to try to heal these spiritual lifts and show that, you know, there is another option out there.
Let's look to Nigeria now. The military claims to know the location of hundreds of missing schoolgirls who were, of course, abducted by the militant group Boko Haram some weeks ago now. This is apparently good news for the families of the missing, according to the army. Slightly less clear what Boko Haram will make of these pronouncements, or indeed what the various other actors in Nigeria, we've got US and Israeli intelligence, amongst others supposedly involved, have been doing, or indeed will do now. Daniel, I just wonder, why do you think the Nigerian military would announce this, especially if you're going to then proceed to go on and explain why doing anything decisive is a really bad idea? What's the strategy here? It seems rather confused and confusing.
I think sometimes we overestimate when we try and attribute strategies to governments and armies. But, well, look, locating them can be hailed as an achievement. And they make a very good point. The Nigerian army in general is not finely calibrated for this kind of rescue operation. Most armies aren't. You can only imagine the consequences if they went storming in. We've seen innumerable hostage crises before. This is not going to work. Also, as I understand it, there was a deal which was close but was called off by the president, which would have seen a swap for the hostages, the Boko Haram officials in custody. I can see why that, again, would have been a bad move and set a troubling precedent. The fact is that we still are in a state of chaos. It doesn't seem that the Nigerian government is able to either effectively control Boko Haram with political means, with security means, or find any kind of political solution. You know, Nigeria is the biggest economy in Africa, but in some ways it's not a functioning state. Certainly when it comes to these girls, they might have been located, I don't know whether that's true or not, but their rescue, any kind of rescue, is as far away as ever.
It does appear to have exposed a number of deficiencies in the sort of regime within Nigeria. Where, Raffaello, do you think this leaves Goodluck Jonathan and his administration then? Because he certainly looks pretty impotent. Does it just highlight the scale of the task facing him, or indeed any rival, in trying to bring the kind of order that Daniela was describing there to this vast and complex country?
Look, I think that the comments by the defense ministry are frankly a reaction to a large protest showing up at the door and the defense minister needing something to say. People were busted and showed up in mass numbers. He's got to go out and speak to the crowd. He says, we found them. We know where they are. Well, yes, we all know where they kind of are. It's in that big chunk of northeastern Nigeria, right? So we've narrowed that down. It's specificity that they don't necessarily know. And even if they do know, I don't think these girls are all together. I think that the Nigerian government has frankly mishandled this from day one. And we've seen a whole catalogue of problems in terms of, you know, on the day that the girls were actually kidnapped, which, by the way, was the same day that there was a large bomb just outside Abuja, which killed somewhere between 70 and 200 people. The president was spotted the next day at a political event dancing. You know, so I think the optics of this is something that the Nigerians have handled very badly. The Nigerian military has, in the past, strategy with dealing with Boko Haram has been essentially one of containment. They've isolated the three sort of northeastern provinces and said, those are the ones where we have a state of emergency. Basically seal them off. That's where Boko Haram acts. That's where it does its thing. We'll leave it up there. And if you look at the electoral map in Nigeria, this is not a part of the country which votes for Goodluck Jonathan's party. So politically speaking, it's not ever been a particular concern to him. The reason it's a concern now is because you've got, you know, the Barack Obama's wife, Michelle, holding up his hashtag Bring Back Our Girls thing. And so there is that moment of sort of mass attention you're getting from the world onto this thing. But we're already starting to see it fade. And in some ways, what's quite depressing about this whole thing is I think there was a moment when the world did have an opportunity to really pressure Nigerian government to really try to do something about a problem which it's frankly been managing for the past five to 10 years. And it's just been managing it and letting this sort of organized chaos continue in a part of the country where it doesn't really have a stake or care. And the international attention could have meant that we could have applied some pressure. However, that attention is now fading. We've got the defense minister making, you know, random statements about he knowing where these people are, or where these girls are. Deals may be coming together, maybe not. We don't really know. I think at this point, the best case scenario is that some of these girls will eventually get recovered. And the group continues to launch attacks. I saw just today there was another attack, 54 people killed. And over the weekend, we saw a double bombing in Jos, killing another 100 or so. So it's a domestic insurgency that the Nigerians have been handling badly, frankly, for quite a while already. I don't see much evidence that's going to change.
And there we must leave it. Raffaello Pantucci and Daniela Peled, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on today's Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our woman in Vancouver. We'll see what happened when a Serbian coach took on South Sudan's football team. And we'll talk music with Raf Rundell of the London-based musical duo The Two Bears. Before all of that, though, let's hear from David Spencer, who has the latest world news headlines.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Ukrainian aircraft and paratroopers have killed more than 50 pro-Russian rebels in an assault in Donetsk. The unprecedented offensive throws a challenge to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who said he reserves the right to defend Russian speakers under threat. He's demanded an end to the offensive. EU leaders are meeting in Brussels to discuss the impact of elections that saw a surge in support for Eurosceptic and far-right parties. The French President, Francois Hollande, says it's shown the need to reform the EU. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif says top diplomats from Pakistan and India will meet soon to advance peace talks. He was speaking after attending new Prime Minister Narendra Modi's inauguration in New Delhi, with whom he said he had a warm and cordial meeting. Thailand's military rulers have detained a former minister after he denounced the coup, saying it would bring disaster. Army Chief General Prayut Chan-o-cha seized power on Thursday, saying the army had to restore order after months of unrest. Japan says it's alarmed by the sinking of a Vietnamese fishing boat in the South China Sea. Vietnam claims Chinese boats rammed the vessel. China claims it capsized after harassing Chinese boats. And Egypt's presidential election has been extended to a third day. The Egyptian government's concerned that a lower-than-expected turnout would undermine the credibility of frontrunner Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. More news from David Spencer at the top of the hour. That's 1900, of course, London time. You're with Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 18.34 in London, 14.34 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our contributors around the world. Today we talk moose, seals, oh yes, and house prices. It's to Vancouver we head now. Lucy Hislop is waiting for us there. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us, as always. Let's start with seals, then. We're talking about the EU, and this is a ban on seal products. Tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an appeal panel that has upheld the World Trade Organization's decision that an earlier EU ban, I think it was in 2010, on real pelts is justified on moral grounds. So actually, it undermines the principles of fair trade, but it can be justified on, I think the words are, fulfills the objective of addressing EU public morals concern on seal welfare. So, it's very interesting, because I always think of Canada is having a sort of a dichotomy between the sort of 90% that are, 50 miles or so from the border with the US, and then the rest of the country, where they have to deal far more with wildlife and the results of seals eating fish, et cetera, et cetera. So, no country kind of likes to be told what it can and can't do, and Canada, the Canadian government, the federal conservative government, is upset by it and says that it is a humane and sustainable and well-regulated hunt, and they're definitely up in arms about it, and especially to be justifying something on moral grounds as opposed to it being actually against trade.
I was going to ask you about that. Do you think people would be happier in broad terms then if it was sold, if you like, on a sort of scientific basis? Is the fact that it's, the EU claims it's on a moral, public moral concerns are being safeguarded, and of course you have the people who are most vocal on this are often sort of very well-known pro-environmental lobby, a lot of sort of Hollywood stars, and does that make it more difficult, do you think, if people have to listen to someone like Paul McCartney or Pamela Anderson waffling away about why this is so important? Does that make it a harder sell within Canada?
I think for most people, they're not walking around in furs, and the history, of course, of Canada of being, trading in fur, that's what built the nation. They're not walking around in furs today. It's moved on. It's a modern country, but it's there was a recent report where we saw Pamela Anderson, and she was. She was dressed Hollywood style, and she went to Newfoundland and got sort of laughed out of the hunting sort of center. But it made for great TV. It was interesting to see. But yeah, they really couldn't be bothered whether she was Hollywood or famous or anything. This was an industry that they believed in and felt that it was important for their well-being, and that, they weren't going to be listening to people like Pamela Anderson coming along.
No, well, that's probably a good thing, actually, in broad terms. Another thing that people are always talking about, and indeed sometimes listening to, is conversations about real estate. Of course, property prices here in London, everyone's obsessed with, the house price bubble. Are we in it? Are we not? But I gather that they're directing their concerns the wrong place. We should be looking to your neck of the woods to find out where the real house price explosion is happening.
Well, it is a really extraordinary thing, because obviously I'm originally from London, and so to come here where I thought I could build, have a mansion and live the life of Riley, I can't. And the interesting thing is it's actually, Canada always looks to somewhere else to tell them what's going on, in a way. And it's the New Yorker magazine that's being retweeted magnificently. And it says that we're not in a bubble. So that's nice to hear. Apparently, the economists have dubbed us a superstar city. And what it is that we've always been a hotspot of Canadian real estate. And the reason why it is one of the most expensive in fact, they say it's the most expensive housing market in North America, is because obviously it's a temperate climate like England, so it's nothing like the rest of Canada. It's on the access to the Pacific Rim and the multicultural aspect of it. And if I sound like a realtor trying to
sell
it's a
place, good job. I'm already looking up properties
online. Yeah,
no,
I'm really not meaning to. What has happened is that, you know, even really a sort of the part kind of most people didn't want to go to, which is the east side, the average house price is $915,000. So, you know, it's just what has happened is that it's regarded as a safe place to park your money. There are places that are vacant, that it's just bought. It's not necessarily homes, it's just parking your money. It's interesting how it has exploded here. It just keeps on going up. And during the recession, we hardly felt a dent.
Extraordinary stuff. Let's move on just briefly, Lucy, because we're almost out of time, but I can't possibly let you leave us without talking about moose. I don't mean the dessert. I'm spelling it with two O's. Tell us why a wild baby moose has been making headlines.
Well, very quickly, it is iconic Canadian wildlife. It's a baby moose, and then it walks into an iconic Canadian brand, which is a Tim Horton. A guy rescues a baby moose from the side of the road. Apparently, it was kept on going into the traffic. So I know you're not supposed to touch or rescue wildlife. So instead of leaving it to nature, it brought it to Tim Hortons, which is the definitive. It's the Starbucks of the States. For a cup of joe before heading to the wildlife sanctuary to leave it in the local animal shelter.
It's my favourite story without any question of the last few days. I would urge our listeners to check out the moose. They're pretty cute creatures when they're small, which took me by surprise.
And luckily there was no moose burger on the menu, so that's all good.
We can all give thanks for that. Lucy Hislop in Vancouver, thank you very much as always for joining us here on Midori House. Up next, we're talking football in South Sudan. Stay tuned.
Each year, the Pre-Pic Day honours photographers who pull focus on challenging environmental issues. Monocle Films reports on the alchemy of this year's images and explores their potential to affect change.
The still image has as much power as it ever had, in spite of the ubiquity of the printed image on the internet and films, videos and everything. I think this exhibition shows that single images can have as much raw power and emotion and can engage so strongly with the senses that you simply cannot forget them.
You can watch our report on the 2014 Prix Pictet by heading to the film section at monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insights.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietrich.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
This is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, the World Cup gets underway in Brazil in just over a fortnight's time, you've probably noticed. While many around the globe are quite rightly anticipating a festival of football, there's often nevertheless an uglier side to the beautiful game. Amnesty International has organised a weekend of special events as part of Sidelines Football Film Festival, which aims to ensure that human rights are front and centre when the big show kicks off in Brazil. Amongst the films on offer in London from the 6th to the 8th of June is a documentary exploring the impact of Zoran Djordjevic Stojanovic, a Serbian coach and true journeyman tasked with galvanising the newly formed South Sudan football team. The film is called Coach Zoran and His African Tigers, and its director, Sam Benster, joins me now here in the studio. Sam, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for coming in to see us. Tell me a little bit about Coach Zoran, because I think people who watch the trailer and who watch the documentary piece will be, what's fair to say, blown away by him and his character. He's a pretty unorthodox approach to the game, doesn't he?
He's an extraordinary man. I mean, he's like a sort of Marmite figure, if you like. people love him or hate him, and he's both at times arrogant and very difficult, but also incredibly passionate, and he was able to bring all of the players with him along on his journey.
Now, tell us a little bit about that journey, because I wanted to ask you whether this film would you characterise it as a football film when people ask you, or is it about, you know, the birth of a nation, or is it kind of about both and how they reflect upon each other?
It's about both, really. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't hugely interested in doing a football story, but more looking for a way into telling the story of the birth of a country. And that's, you know, an extraordinarily special and rare thing. And not only is it the birth of a new country, but it's also a country that's starting from right at the back of the grid. It's at the bottom of all the development indices. And even also at the bottom of the football rankings, literally, they start out ranked 209th in the world. I mean, a few people wouldn't really even know that there were that many countries that play football.
And tell me then about the role that you, I guess, came to understand that football played then in that process, that birth of a nation, because it had been born out of this, you know, a half a century of conflict and division, all of that tumult, as you said, so many disadvantages, I guess, confronting everybody there. What role does football play? Is it sort of a beacon, to use a dreadful footballing cliche, that people can kind of look to? Or does it almost offer something more fundamental than that, because it shows what unity and what direction and what a bit of sort of passion can actually deliver?
Yeah, I mean, it is a cliche, but it really did bind them all together, and you would have a team of people made up from different warring tribes who had been fighting for years and whose tribe, I mean, in one case, one tribe was responsible for massacring another tribe while we were filming. But amongst the players, that none of that sort of conflict existed, and it really did transcend all of that. And I think, you know, any new country, especially one coming from all the difficulty that they had come from, is looking for something to bind them together. And the football really did do that. And it was a really special moment when they played their first international game, and they sung their national anthem, which, you know, that people had only just learnt. And the words were about all the people who died in the Civil War. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. You know, it was a really special moment.
I don't want to sort of, you know, have to deliver a spoiler alert, and we don't want to sort of ruin the film from those who are going to watch it. But it's there's a lot of ups and downs, as I guess one would imagine when you look at the sort of the landscape at the beginning. Is it a positive story, though, or is it a realistic story about exactly how complex these sorts of processes can be?
It's funny, when you look at most sports documentaries, they always seem to deliver unlikely stories of underdog success, you know, that are sort of cool runnings, if you like, type story. And I initially set out with a similar idea in mind, and you quickly realise it's just not going to happen for them. Everything is going disastrously badly. And so it's about a story about looking for the positivity and the redemption, if you like, amidst the chaos and disaster.
And just a final thought about Zoran Djordjevic. I know I asked you about him at the beginning, but these movies you mentioned, these documentary pieces, tend to throw up as well as unlikely sort of story arcs, unlikely heroes as well. And he is a man who, I don't know, could you capture the full measure of the man? Or do you think it would take a lifetime to do that job? Because he is an extraordinary individual, isn't he?
He is. I mean, I hope that we have done him justice. He is a figure who is actually quite close to my heart. You know, when you're making a film like this, you live and die with the characters that you film, and you get incredibly close to them. And we went through some extraordinary moments together. And afterwards, what was interesting was the reaction to the film amongst his family was mixed. I think his sons and wife were quite protective of him, but he loved the film and was very supportive of it and was there for the premiere in Holland, and so I hope that he feels that we did him justice.
I think people who watch the piece will probably feel that you probably did. It's Coach Zoran and his African Tiger, Sam Benstead, the director. Thanks very much for joining us. You can catch it from other places as well at the festival here in London. That's not this weekend, but the one after. Sam, thanks very much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you.
You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time to review the best, sometimes worst, in the worlds of television, theatre, books and more. Today we're talking music. A little earlier, Monocle's Paul Noble sat down with Raph Rundell of the London-based musical duo The Two Bears.
Raph Rundell, welcome into Monocle 24.
Hello.
Hello, we've been trying to get you in for years. You've been very busy.
I have, yeah. I had no idea. I would have come much sooner. It's very nice here.
You didn't know we had such a setup here.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was just you.
No, there's a few others kicking around. So Two Bears is you and Joe Goddard from Hot Chip.
That's right.
I don't need to ask why you're called the Two Bears, but I do need to ask how you met and where you decided to start making music together.
It was someone else's idea that we were called the Two Bears, actually. We were originally called the Three Bears. Our mutual friend, Stephen Bass, who released Hot Chip's first record and manages Metronomy, he's a sort of indie fantasist, and he had a fantasy that we'd start a band. This was before I ever was making music or singing or anything, and he said, oh, you should start a band with the Joe Mount from Metronomy and Joe Goddard from Hot Chip, and you should be called the Three Bears. That never really happened, but when Joe and I started making music together, Joe Goddard and I, it's hard to come up with a good name, and so we just took that one and robbed Joe Mount out of the, in a sort of... Stalinist way.
Yeah.
We chopped him off the end of the picture.
One bear down.
But we might, you know, we have pretensions and hopes that that might happen one day.
And did you start off with a manifesto? Did you have an idea of this is where we want to be and this is the kind of music we want to make?
No, not at all. We just got in there and kind of felt our way through it, really. The first thing was a cover of a Sade record. I was on the dole listening to Diamond Life on a sort of Tuesday afternoon in my underpants, and that song, When Am I Going to Make a Living, came on, and I was like, I should probably cover this. It seems quite apposite. And I took it to Joe, and that was the first thing we did, and that went on the first EP. And like off the back of the first really three or four tracks we made, we got a record deal and just sort of got on with it. The whole thing grew very naturally. And yeah, we just finished making The Difficult Second, you know.
Yes, the elusive second album.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a bit. Let's start digging into some of your music.
Okie doke.
You've brought in a few tunes for us. So
yeah.
What's first? What's tickling your ears this week?
It's probably, you know, the words guilty pleasure get bandied around a little bit too much for my liking. And actually, there's nothing guilty about it. This is a brilliant record. Usher, it's a new Usher tune. It's called Good Kisser. Make every minute worth it, baby. This for Usher, baby. I done been around the world. I done kissed a lot of girls, so I'm guessing that it's true. Make me holler and I bet $1 million. Don't nobody kiss it like you. Don't nobody kiss it like you. Don't nobody kiss it like you. Bang, bang, bang. Don't nobody kiss it like you. Don't nobody kiss it like you. It's 5 in the morning. Cush is rolling while she making steak and eggs. Yeah. Don't problem. At 5 in the morning, we can only be about to do one thing. So the devil is a lie. Them other girls can't compete with mine. You do it so good, you fuck my mind. You pull it out, then you open by. You make me want to tap out every time. Your pretty lips leave me so inspired. I think that she a winner. She could be a keeper, cause she's such a good kisser. He's an amazing vocalist, isn't he?
He can do the lot. He can sing and do a handstand at the same time.
I've seen him. I once saw him. You saw it. Saw him do a PA, and it was like it when he started singing. When he went into the falsetto, it reminded me of footage I've seen of like Marvin Gaye in the '70s, and like when he sings, it's just like everyone, all the women go. It was exactly what happened. Same actually when I saw Frank Ocean last year. It's like the power of the voice, isn't it? Yeah, pretty special.
So let's just touch on your second album. How painful was that in the making? Because you've finished it now.
We're done. Yeah. Painful. It wasn't painful, But it definitely, like, we definitely worked quite hard at it. We wanted to make something different. There's a few things we wanted to say, probably. It's quite quietly political, I suppose. And there's a lot of things we wanted to try out, a lot of musical hats we wanted to try on. And I've sort of really decided just to go for it and sing a bit more this time. There's a reggae tune on there. There's all sorts, yeah, called Keith's on there. It's quite varied again. I hope that anyone that liked the first one will like this one, and we might catch a few more.
Let's move into your next track. What have you got for us?
The next track is by a producer called Wookie, who will be familiar to anyone who was into sort of UK garage in the 90s and early noughties. He was part of the Soul crew out of Camden and made some big hits back then, and he's sort of still around. This is a new one. It's called Higher.
Don't wanna set that, 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 that.
And anyone with a subwoofer attached to their radio.
Watch your bass bins.
Watch your bass bins, as they say. talking of which, you're in the middle of a residency.
Yeah.
In one of London's finer nightclubs.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
We are 6 weeks into our 12-week Saturday night residency at a club called XOYO, which is in Shoreditch. We've had some amazing guests so far. We had Fortet and Caribou last week. Oh, crikey, who we had? We'd had the Pachanga Boys and Artwork the week before. We've got Hot Chip coming in this weekend. The whole thing upstairs is hosted by some friends of ours who run a party called Sink the Pink, which is a kind of transvestite, cross-dressing sort of mess of lycra and fun and games in the Bethnal Green Working Men's Club, and they've taken over the top room. They all look a little bit like the girl that just won Eurovision on the weekend.
Mm, the bearded lady.
The bearded lady. That's their kind of vibes. It's been a really great thing to do, and it's a launch pad of a kind for the record that we've made that's coming out in September, and it's been a lot of fun, been really good for our chops as DJs as well.
Absolutely.
You learn a lot, you know.
Let's move on to your third tune.
The third tune is I'll play our new single.
Mm.
I'll blow our trumpets here.
Do we need to get the exclusive button?
You might have been trumped on that one.
Oh.
Sorry.
Okay.
Someone else might have played it on the radio. Pete Tong, okay. One of his mates up the road's probably had a go on it by now.
Right.
It's our new single, and the video's just gone up. It involves me driving around South London having a breakdown, an existential breakdown as opposed to a mechanical one in the car. and I hope people like it. It's called Angel.
Okay, Raph Rundle from Two Bears, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
And we'll be seeing you over the summer at nightclubs and festivals around the world.
You will.
That was Raph Rundle of the London-based musical duo The Two Bears with Monocle's Goldilocks Paul Noble. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to my special guest from a little earlier, Daniela Peled and Raffaello Pantucci. Today's show was expertly produced, as always, by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Baker, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. And next up, after the headlines, Section D, our weekly design show at 2200 hours London time, of course, at the Monocle Daily with Emma and Andrew. Do stay tuned for that. This show returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, of course. But for this Tuesday edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, it is goodbye. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.